Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters, and APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening from me, Ray White, in for Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show. And such an interesting story. Marcus Yerster has until the 19th of April to pay 475 million rand. The question is, how much money does he really have? The answer could be that he doesn't have that, and that they probably going to go after his assets. My big question is, why has nothing happened up until now? Why have there been no arrests in this matter? It's South Africa's biggest ever financial scandal. And I know the NPA in the past have said they didn't have the capacity to investigate such financial crimes, but I think that things have changed since then. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens with this court judgment, or Marcus Yerster, will he appeal it? Where's it going to go with this? Not a court judgment, it is from the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, so they have ruled on this. But the big thing is what is going to be happening next, and whether he can pay or not. And also, where is Marcus Yerster? Is he at his house in Hermanus? Is that where he's hanging out? All these questions do need to be answered. Well, also coming up in your program this evening, a high inflation figure, looking at what this means for interest rates. I'll be discussing that with Johan Els from the Old Mutual Group shortly. And then positive half-year results for Discovery. They've been doing very well. They've got these private businesses going, or these extensions of Discovery going, so I'll be finding out more about that one. And then tonight, our shapeshifter is the CEO of Pay Just Now, Craig Newborn. I'm looking forward to that discussion at about 25 minutes to 8 this evening. Love to hear from you. Give me a call, 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567, or perhaps you just want to send a WhatsApp on 31702.
Your voice.
Your station. Let's walk the talk.
702.
Well, let's climb right into it. And inflation has surged to 5.6%. That was for February. It's highest since October. Now, this has dealt quite a blow, I would think, to hopes for a rate cut. Many people saying, you know, my bond repayments every month is so high. I need this to come down. I'm paying too much for my car. Well, we have this inflation figure now. And on the line is Johan Els, who's the Group Chief Economist at Old Mutual. Hi, Johan. Welcome back to The Money Show.
Hi, good evening.
Good to have you on. What's driving this inflation figure? Why so high?
Well, we've had a couple of petrol price increases that was unexpected late last year into this year. But of course, this specific number was a significant increase in medical aid tariffs, much higher than what we expected. And specifically, that component medical insurance rose by 10.3% on a month-on-month basis, and now running almost 13% year-on-year. So that added quite a bit to this monthly number.
And also even egg prices going up. Everything's going up wherever you look. There has to be some sort of light at the end of this tunnel.
Actual fact, you know, there's very little price pressures outside of petrol and this medical costs, medical aid and other medical costs. If you look at consumer goods, vehicles, furniture, appliances, clothing and footwear, they're all slipping on a year-on-year basis in terms of inflation numbers there. But even on a shorter-term picture, the underlying picture is looking better. Food inflation is slipping. So there's not a lot of price pressures out there. And we have to keep in mind, though, that some of these price increases tend to be deflationary in nature. I don't know about you, but most consumers in this country has got a limited monthly budget, which means we spend more on medical costs or medical aid, or we spend more on petrol. So we have limited money available to spend on other goods and services, and that keeps a kind of a lid on other price increases. And that's why, even though this was a shocker, and even though, you know, petrol price increases lifts the headline number, I think the underlying picture for the rest of this year isn't that dire at all. Food inflation, as I say, other consumer goods prices are coming down. The problem is, in terms of interest rates, is that the Reserve Bank realizes that you and me, as the average consumer, we keep an eye on these cost increases, and we tend to build that into our expectations. And so that's the limiting factor why the Reserve Bank will be concerned about a headline number like this.
Right, okay, then let's put your head on the block. In 2 months' time, is it going to be rates unchanged, in fact, for the rest of the year maybe?
No, I think those interest rate cuts are still coming. I think they're going to be later than initially thought. The problem, well, we're not going to see a cut in March. They're going to sound very hawkish, I think, given these latest inflation numbers. May is difficult. Fortunately, the MPC meeting in May happens one day after the elections. So should they wanted to cut, they couldn't be accused of trying to influence the outcome of the election. The problem one day after is we won't have the result of the election yet, and there might be volatility in the currency markets as a result of that uncertainty. So they probably don't want to cut one day after the elections. So that means, yeah, I think more and more the probability is that the first rate cut has been shifted out to the July meeting. That's pretty late. That's pretty late. You know, this underlying inflation picture has been softening. You run the risk of underlying inflation dipping much closer to the lower end of the target range. But I think that's a risk the Reserve Bank is willing to take. So base case, I think increasingly thinking that the first rate cut will be in July.
Yeah. Johan, there has been some talk about changing the inflation target of the Reserve Bank. They've got between 3 and 6%, but perhaps changing that. What are your thoughts?
I think that's a good idea. So essentially coming from the midpoint 4.5 down to 3. The Reserve Bank has been talking about that. Discussion died down a little bit because of the COVID interruption in terms of inflation. But recently, Treasury has picked up on that as well, because, of course, it's Treasury that sets the target for the Reserve Bank to achieve. I think that's a good idea. That will bring lots more stability in terms of the currency as well, our inflation closer to U.S. inflation as an example. But I think we shouldn't be too concerned that that will keep upward pressure on interest rates in the very short term, because that's going to be a process. We're not there yet, and once that target is perhaps set at 3%, there will be a period that the Reserve Bank will allow themselves for the implementation to get towards those lower inflation rates. So it's not going to be immediate, because that would be a lot of pain for the rest of us if they need to adjust interest rates upwards immediately to get to that target in that very short period.
Yeah.
So I think overall a good direction, but we should be aware that it's going to be implemented over perhaps a number of years.
Yeah, let's wait and see what happens. Johan Els, who's the Group Chief Economist at Old Mutual, thank you so much for coming on to The Money Show.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
All right, that's a bit of bad news for the day, but Discovery celebrating a little bit. Now, Discovery is eyeing future growth with positive half-year results. They've had actually a nice result coming out, and also a monthly operational break-even for Discovery Bank. Now, Discovery reported an 11% jump in half-year headline earnings. It's benefiting, it says, from strong growth in its new businesses. And on the line is the founder and group CEO at Discovery, Adrian Gore. Hi, Adrian. Good evening. Welcome back to The Money Show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you on. This is good news. I mean, tell us more about the new business growth. It's quite intriguing.
Well, I think, you know, we've been through a fairly lengthy investment cycle of building new businesses. During the last year or so, we've really been focused on streamlining and getting businesses to scale. In the 6 months, Discovery Bank really performed remarkably well. Our shared value model, Vitality Chassis, has evolved and matured significantly. We're investing a lot in that. Ping An Health, our Chinese health insurer, are sharing that in that business. That business has done incredibly well. So we have a number of businesses forming that are just kind of really doing well. Our model around the world working with partners has grown. So it's been a very complex time over the last 18 months, but I would argue particularly productive. We've seen kind of how that growth is starting to affect the group. I tried to explain this morning in our presentation that the effect of these on the group should be an additional 5 to 10% growth for the group just as these come through. So obviously, we've got a lot of work to do, but I think we're feeling good about where we are.
Yeah. Does it come down to having a great team around you where you're constantly saying to them, all right, guys, disrupt, disrupt, find new ideas. We have to reinvent ourselves somewhat.
It's an interesting insight that, I mean, it's all about people. I mean, the quality of our business is fundamental about the remarkable team that we have. And I mean that. That is how it is. But it's actually maybe the opposite of that in the sense that I think the discovery shared value model, the vitality shared value model, is repeatable and scalable in different markets. And we've seen from the data the amazing cause and effect of behavior change, the effect on mortality, sickness levels, you know, default levels in the bank, et cetera, et cetera. So what's happened to us is actually not a plethora of different ideas, a repeatable model that just kind of keeps scaling, and our AI is here, so you can personalize, and GLP-1s are here, and it goes from one thing to another, but ironically, it's on the same track of repeatability.
Yeah. All right, now, Discovery Bank, break-even results for Discovery Bank. How can you get more of the market? What are you looking at?
Well, I think Discovery Bank's performance has been tremendous. I actually don't think I wouldn't call it algorithmic, but the way the bank is rolling out, we just need to keep doing what we're doing. We're getting 1,000 great quality clients a day coming into the bank. The actual levels of engagement in the bank are tremendous. So the NIR, kind of the revenue being generated, is significant. During this period, we reached an operational break even. And if it just keeps growing like that, I think just if you look at the financial gearing, how the bank plays out, will be significant in terms of the group. And it's proving to be what you're calling a composite maker. So that's pulling the products together on the face of the bank, and people using the bank are just finding it incredibly compelling. So I don't think it has to, let's just keep doing what we're doing, which is not easy. The team has done an amazing job. But if the growth continues like it is, the bank scale will emerge very quickly.
Yeah. Right. Let me ask you a question that Bruce has asked you quite a few times. And the president saying, where is my pen? I'm talking about NHI. Of course, that affects medical aids. What is the latest from a discovery point of view? Obviously, you've got these lovely results, but I'm sure you must be factoring into the whole NHI sort of, I wouldn't say ogre, but the whole cloud that's coming your way.
You know, I actually think that it's an important issue, obviously, but it must be put into the correct context. The country needs universal health coverage. We've been pretty clear that we are committed to helping and doing what we can. I think as a private sector, like with the vaccine, we believe in collaboration. I think when you actually look at the amount of money we have as a country, we cannot offer a comprehensive NHI at this stage. You need dramatic growth in the economy, which is difficult to achieve. So we've been unequivocal in making the point. Unless you have private sector collaboration, the NHI is not workable. In its current form, there are one or two clauses in the NHI bill that make that problematic. We think that those can be changed. We've made those points numerous times to government, and we hope wisdom will prevail. But I think to be fair to all parties, this is a decade or more. This is an intergenerational process. I don't think people should be concerned that the bill is signed and things change. This is taking time. But the bill is problematic in its current form in that it doesn't allow private sector collaboration. You need more funding. So I think ultimately things will settle. It's a complicated issue, but it's a lot bigger than us. It's really an issue for the country.
Yeah, but at one discovery place, you must be meeting there to decide on contingency plans. What if it happens? Sure, there is the Constitutional Court and it has to pass constitutional muster, but you must be thinking about this.
So I think in its current form, it will be challenged by many parties. And I think that is a process that is probably inevitable. Having said that, though, I think that it is going to take a long, long time, and we continue to invest in Discovery Health. We continue to promote the incredible excellence, I think, of our private healthcare system as a national asset. And it's something that, of course, because we're working with, we are poring over stuff all the time, but we don't see a change to the status quo as it is now. And therefore, the focus on the business, the investment, we're building technology, et cetera. We continue to do that, and we'll see how it plays out. I think that we should be realistic and pragmatic about just the reality. We don't have the funding, but we have to work to make things workable. And that is the approach of Discovery. I hope it's clear, constructive and pragmatic.
Adrian Gore, founder and group chief executive officer at Discovery, thank you so much for coming on to The Money Show, and congrats on your positive half-year results.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Chris Stewart, who's the portfolio manager at 91. Hi, Chris. Good to chat to you once again.
Yes, good evening, Ray.
All right, we've been talking about it, this horrible inflation figure that's presented itself, and we were chatting to Johan Els earlier on from Old Mutual, and he was basically saying it's going to have to be a wait-and-see game when it comes to the Reserve Bank. How do you see things playing out with this inflation figure? Where do you see the Reserve Bank going, and also where do you see inflation going?
Yeah, Ray, I mean, it was very interesting that the previous caller or guest that you just had on the show is Adrian Gore, because I think responsibility for the inflation print and the uptick in the inflation print for the most recent month was the inclusion of the annual medical aid increases coming through. And that, I think, is that and a little bit of transport inflation largely as a result of the fuel price has caused the data to tick up very slightly on a month-on-month basis. I don't think it materially derails the inflation story and the fact that inflation should, in South Africa, continue to track towards the midpoint of the guidance range and start to provide some latitude to the central bank to ease monetary policy probably towards the second half of the year. I think most people are probably penciling in a 25 basis point cut in the July MPC meeting and possibly another couple of 25 basis point cuts later on this year. There's obviously a lot of contingencies there. That would be the core expectation right now, provided the oil price doesn't completely misbehave, provided the Rand doesn't completely fall out of bed. There's a lot of geopolitical risks out there, and I don't think our monetary authorities are going to want to start cutting rates until we've seen the US cut. So it's going to be quite important to see what the US monetary authorities say tonight. The Fed is meeting today. There will be a Fed announcement later on today. I have no doubt that they will leave rates on hold. But the outlook statement and the so-called dot plot, the expectations of the market as to when the US are going to be able to start cutting rates. If they can start cutting rates by June, we're probably still on track for a first rate cut in July.
I was actually reading that a few central banks want to break ranks with the US Fed and may actually start cutting rates earlier on. There seems to be this overall positivity.
Yeah, most of them probably sit in developed markets, I would argue. There's not too many emerging market central bankers who I think want to go out alone unless they are beating to a very, very different inflationary drum to the rest of the world. There may be base effects and very high inflation rates in certain emerging markets, which would warrant already rate cuts to start being contemplated. But I suspect, given the conservatism inherent in the central bank in South Africa, I would be very surprised at this rate if they were to pull the trigger before the Fed.
Yeah. All right, Investec trading update today. Some interesting news there.
Yeah, Investec giving a pre-close trading update for their March year-end period based on the 11 months of trading to the end of February. And it was a pretty positive trading update once again. I mean, we've seen Investec for the last number of years post a fairly major restructuring and indeed the unbundling of Investec Asset Management, which is now the 91 company for which I work. Subsequent to that unbundling, we've seen Investec, focusing on an internal restructuring within the group, focusing very closely on a sort of three-year financial plan that they set with financial metrics for the financial year end ending 31 March 2024. In other words, the period that we're coming towards. And, they've consistently beaten the market expectations. And I think they've done it again today, announcing a strong outlook for headline earnings growth for the year, probably somewhere around 5% ahead of what the market was looking for at the beginning of this year. We have seen modest positive earnings revisions taking place already this year, but I think still comfortably beating what the market was expecting for the year. And that reflected in a good sort of 2-3% increase in the share price today.
All right, Chris, your bosses are listening. Where is it that 91's getting it right? Was it just the whole unbundling, which was a super idea at the time, or what actually was the game changer when it came to the unbundling?
No, I think the unbundling of Investec Asset Management to become 91 was kind of neither here nor there. Investec retained a fairly significant stake for a period of time. They obviously unbundled a portion of 91 At the time of their major restructure. They've obviously sold a few more shares subsequent to that. They still own a residual 10% stake in the company in the United Kingdom, which they may or may not exit over time. It remains to be seen, and that's, I guess, their choice. But, you know, from an investor group perspective, I think more importantly, they've really gone back to a focus on capital discipline within the group, cleaning up some of the, non-core operations within the group, clearly defining their financial targets and their capital management plans, their return targets over the subsequent 3 years, and then sticking to that, continuing to manage capital within the group effectively. The return on equities improved significantly. They've put together a track record over a number of years of consistent earnings growth. They've been buying back shares, reducing their share count. And the markets appreciated that and rewarded them thus far by re-rating the company. Although if you look at the sort of multiples upon which the company is still trading, you could argue that there's further credit that they probably deserve, given that the business still trades on very modest price earnings multiples, sort of, less than 6x earnings 1 year forward, discounts to book value still. So there's probably still more to be gained there, I would argue.
More to come. Right, now the news, retail sales slightly down, or actually down 2.1%, I think it was. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, there was a modest uptick in the December month-on-month retail sales number. We know that December was a reasonable month for the retailers, partly due to base effects. If you remember last year, the sort of Black Friday November sales was something of a damn squib compared to the 2022 November number. So, there wasn't much Black Friday activity in November last year, which meant that December sales could be a little bit better. But what we've seen in January, and this is somewhat consistent with the most recent trading updates we've seen out of the retailers themselves, we have seen quite a precipitous slowdown in January. This data point really confirming that retail sales in the new year have got off to a fairly sluggish start. And I guess it's not really surprising. If you look at where interest rates are at the moment, prime lending rates at 11.75%, as we've said, probably no relief in sight until the second half of calendar 2024. We've seen the banks indicating that non-performing loans amongst particularly the retail part of their books remain fairly elevated. They're stabilizing, but they remain fairly elevated. So consumers have got debt out there. Debt servicing costs are high. Incomes are not increasing, particularly in the current environment. And as a result of that, I think discretionary income is a scarcity. And with discretionary income being relatively scarce, we're seeing that reflected in retail sales. The apparel retail numbers looking particularly weak in January. And I guess that's one of the more discretionary parts of the basket.
They don't call it January for nothing. Chris Stewart, Portfolio Manager at 91, thank you so much for joining us on The Money Show. I do appreciate you taking the time. It's just gone 6:30.
Your voice.
Your station. Let's walk the talk.
702.
Well, coming up on the program shortly, talking about Actis entering into negotiations to acquire the SwiftNet tower firm. That's from Telkom. This whole deal is valued at about 6.3 billion rand. So finding out more about that. And then a little bit later on, in February, there was a 2.5% increase in the average salary, indicating positive growth to take home pay. That is good news if you think about it, because we are battling with our salaries. And I know you're thinking, Ray, 2.5%, but it is something. And it's always been the big debate between what you earn and what the salary increase is versus inflation, and then versus what I call real inflation. Real inflation is not what 5.8%. It's nothing like that. Real inflation is the one where you've got to pay for your school fees and other things, and all of a sudden you're going to find 10,000 rand somewhere and 20,000 rand somewhere, and you just don't go and get that 13th check. So it is a bit of a problem. I'll be chatting to an expert on this, talking about a positive growth rate in take-home pay. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on. But let's have a look at Actis entering into negotiations to acquire the SwiftNet tower firm from Telkom. The deal is valued at 6.3 billion rand. On the line is Dobek Pater, who's a telecoms analyst at Africa Analysis in Johannesburg. Dobek, hi, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray. Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you on. Now, just take us through this deal. What does it involve and why the SwiftNet Tower?
Well, SwiftNet, which is a one of the sort of units within the Telkom group, has had all the towers allocated to it. And towers are effectively the, what's called the passive infrastructure, the structures that you see. You know, some of them look as palms or similarly disguised, and they effectively act as a structure to mount radio equipment, radio network equipment from the mobile operators or other wireless operators. What has been so, Telkom has decided to maybe carve that unit out of the company, either list it on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange or to sell it. Obviously, you know, it's now apparently talking to actors in that respect. It is a trend that has been globally taking place for more than a decade in across Africa, also for quite a while. South Africa was a little bit later to adopt that trend. The mobile operators have liked to own and manage their own towers, that passive infrastructure for their mobile sites. But they have started selling the towers to third parties or separating them out of the actual active network infrastructure operations. And we've got a number of what's called tower cos or tower companies, typically global companies that own this infrastructure, this tower infrastructure globally in different countries. And they do so across Africa, some of them, and have been also buying assets in South Africa.
So that would be Actis. I mean, who exactly are Actis? I must admit, before this interview, I did Google them because I wasn't aware about their activities.
Now, well, Actis would be a newcomer to the tower market, I think globally, as far as I'm aware, not only in South Africa, but it's not new to South Africa itself. I mean, other actors, tower cos that we have in South Africa are American Tower Corporation, Helios Towers, IHS. Actis owns actually a controlling stake in a fiber network operator in South Africa called Octotel, based in Cape Town, with aspirations to expand into other parts of South Africa, but focused on the Western Cape. Also, a minority stake in RSA Web, which is one of the internet service providers in South Africa, also headquartered in Cape Town. They have already maybe bought interest in a smaller data center in Nigeria. So they are building up a digital infrastructure portfolio, which is something that some of the companies have been doing globally. And I think the best example we've got in South Africa is CIVH with Remgrow Interests, CIVH being a shareholder, owner of Dark Fiber Africa in Vumatel, has created the company called Massive now and are looking to sell 30 to 40% stake of that in Vodacom. Currently being looked at it by the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal in May. Actis itself is an global investor that invests in various infrastructure. Predominantly, it looks like various energy infrastructure, energy operations, a lot of it renewables, airport infrastructure, things, so logistics, and then also owns some real estate and so forth.
Yeah. Just hearing you say that, is there any sort of regulation between these players? Because it sounds like a whole lot of new names that perhaps most of us haven't heard of. Is there regulation or is it just business as usual?
In the tower market itself, tower infrastructure, it's business as usual, as you say. So effectively you buy towers from a company that's typically a mobile operator that owns them. So MTN, for instance, sold its towers to IHS. So not all of them, but most of them. MTN would then lease space on those towers from the TowerCo, the entity that now owns and manages that passive tower infrastructure. Now, the reason operators do it is to save costs. They transfer the capex that they would keep investing in building these towers and opex to maintain the towers into OPEX where they lease space, but it's also sort of getting rid of a headache to an extent. What the TowerCos have also been doing is providing additional value-add services. One of them is power redundancy. So with problems that we have in South Africa, for instance, with the power supply from Eskom or the municipalities, it becomes a big challenge for mobile operators to keep some of their active network sites going and actually operating during those power outages. So they've been trying to transfer some of that, some of those problems onto the TowerCos, and TowerCos do it in order to provide a better full suite service. Some of them notably have disengaged from that because even for them, Eskom became a bit too much, a bit too costly, trying to manage that power supply constantly and the redundancy. Yeah. They've also been offering security. So, for instance, security guards managing managing the security environment around the towers due to vandalism and things such as battery theft, which is quite rampant in South Africa. So operators effectively are trying to shed that passive infrastructure responsibility, pass it on to a third party that specializes in it. Some companies, two companies notably in South Africa, mobile operators, have still owned their towers, and one of them is Swiftnet from the Telkom Group. The other one is a company called Mast that Vodacom created, effectively carving out its tower infrastructure out of other Vodacom operations, but it still owns them. It may continue to own them. It may ultimately decide to also dispose of them.
Right.
Depends on the strategy. But ultimately, we are going to start seeing a lot more infrastructure sharing taking place in South Africa. So lowering the costs to the mobile operators.
Exactly. What about us, towers? The consumer? Dominic, what about us, the consumer? Because we want to pay less, you know.
I think another aspect to consider is that as we move further into the 5G, the fifth generation network environment, and 6G that will follow on from that, that's already being developed, there is going to be a requirement for a lot more of this passive infrastructure. A lot of it is going to be so-called small cells, small sites within shopping centers, business district environments, but those networks will become a lot more densified, i.e. a lot more radio equipment being around you everywhere in order to provide good quality, high throughput broadband services to connect to the internet and make use of an array of applications, watch videos while you're shopping and so forth. All of that is going to require additional infrastructure, so it just makes more sense for the operators to sell that portfolio and then let the TowerCos actually provide that infrastructure in the future. They just will go and lease the space as required.
Sure. I certainly hope this is going to happen. Dobek Pato, who's the telecoms analyst at Africa Analysis in Johannesburg. Dobek, thank you so much for your insight this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
Ray, in for Bruce on your next Money Show. Well, we'll have Gary Boyson, director at Rand Swiss. He will be our investment school headmaster. Boyson will give you critical tips to help you fatten your investment portfolio. Then Clive Butko, who's co-founder of Conducive Capital, will discuss the necessity of startups, how to grow them in South Africa, and what fundamental factors they need in order to attract venture capital. Also, we'll help you understand the importance stories around the world concerning finance. All this and more coming up on your next Money Show.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Right, we've had bad inflation data today and retail sales aren't doing so well, but there is good news for salaries. In February, there was a 2.5% increase in the average salary, indicating positive growth in take-home pay. So that is something. I know it's 2.5%, but it is something. On the line is Elise Kruger, who's an independent economist. Hi, Elise. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray.
All right, so what sort of trends are you seeing? I mean, 2.5% is something. We need those salary increases. We need to see average salaries going up.
Yes, we are quite, you know, encouraged by seeing a third consecutive month that the Banks of Africa take-home pay is increasing somewhat on a monthly basis. So that is definitely good news. And it's given it, that it's been 3 months in a row, we hope it could become a trend for the rest of 2024. However, you know, the context is always important. And if you look at the past 2 years, the years have been quite dismal for take-home pay. You know, given that we had high inflation numbers, you know, 2022 we were at 6.9, last year 6% average headline, and salary increases did not keep up with those type of inflation rates. So we saw in the economy real declines in salaries, and now for the past 3 months that seemed to have started to turn around. So we are quite, you know, thankful and optimistic that we could start to see that, you know, as a trend. And then we should overall hopefully see 2024 to be a better year compared to the previous 2 years.
What's changing, though? What's been the big changing factor in all of this? And it's lovely to see salaries going up, because I'm thinking about those who are battling to pay for their bonds and their cars, and that repo rate is just not coming down. So what's been driving all of this then?
Yes, you know, it's almost difficult to say, because it's an economic environment that feels like, you know, very similar to what we had in 2023. Although, you know, on the load shedding side, we start to see a slightly better scenario playing out. And if you just think about how that has been a very negative overlay for the whole of 2023, I think that is at least alleviating somewhat. Inflation numbers are coming down. I know today's number has been a bit of a bummer, at 5.6, but, you know, looking a year ago, we were at 6.9. So, you know, we've seen a moderation in inflation, although a bit more gradual than what we hoped for. So that is playing into the scenario of slightly better business environment. It's not significantly so yet, and therefore we are saying it is early days for the trends that we are picking up over the past 3 months in the bank serve data. But looking forward, you know, we bank on a better second half for 2024, especially given that we could hopefully see some cuts in interest rates in the second half on the back of a similar movement in global interest rates. Also, on our side, you know, hopefully inflation will also moderate towards the midpoint of the target band. So we are sticky in the first half of the year. It's been expected. But hopefully in the second half of the year, on the back of the expectation that the rand could alleviate somewhat. So, you know, there's lots of assumptions, obviously, in this environment. And at the moment, the rand is sticky around 19. So that is a big risk for us in terms of expecting this to play out in the second half of the year. But, you know, economic growth-wise as well, I mean, we're looking at forecasting, well, for forecast is 1.3%. That is about double of last year. So the overall environment, somewhat better.
Yeah, and also as well, just hearing you say that, I'm thinking that perhaps companies are becoming more resilient. Yes, we've had load shedding. It's continued, but perhaps companies are getting their generators going or their solar power going. They've come up with a plan. So despite what government is not doing or things that are not happening, people are surviving. Companies are becoming resilient.
That is indeed true. And, you know, I heard somebody saying recently that one of South Africa's biggest assets actually are our good management teams that, you know, managed to take us through whatever curveballs this economy slash government is throwing at us. You know, so I think, yes, indeed, I mean, we've seen huge investment into mitigation measures for load shedding in the past 12, 18 months. Definitely that is starting to alleviate, you know, that pressure that we have seen somewhat. So I'm optimistic that this year could be the better year, although it feels currently like a bit of a hangover as well, because, you know, given the last 2 years of stress in the economy, it's not going to disappear overnight. But things are happening slowly but surely on the structural reform side, and I think we could start to see the impact thereof as we go forward.
But are companies being realistic when it comes to salary increases? Inflation's 5.7%, but are they being realistic? Because we're looking at school fees, we're looking at unexpected things that are way beyond 10%.
Yes, I suppose, you know, it's a matter of, are you going to be happy with a slightly lower salary increase and still have a job? or are you going to fight for inflation plus one, and then maybe some of the workforce will have to, be greeted? So I think it's a fine line between, obviously knowing you need to give more, but also wanting to preserve the job opportunities for your people. So, over the past 2 years, what we have witnessed was slower than inflation salary increases on average in the economy. I'm talking here Reserve Bank data that's actual. For 2022, it was a 3.8% increase. For 2023, a 4.6%. And we know where the inflation rates, turned around. So I think from that point of view, companies definitely wanted to keep skills and they want to award, people. But it's against the background of a very dismal economic situation. And what do you do? Would you keep the doors open with a lower salary increase, or will you, at all costs say we will give inflation plus one and see what to, if we can still manage to survive? That type of argument, I think, has been around in the boardrooms all along.
Sure. Baby steps, I suppose. Elise Kruger, who's an independent economist, good to have you on The Money Show. Just gone 7 o'clock, this Eyewitness News is brought to you by Telkom Business. It's time to do business big. Click telkom.co.za for more info.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock. Good evening from me, Ray White, in for Bruce Whitfield. And The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Well, coming up in a program in the next hour, talking about not neglecting your change management in digital transformation. What that means is if you're going to go onto a new system, you're going to upgrade yourself, just be careful, make sure that number one, your staff know what's going on, and number two, that the software actually works. So we'll be talking about that shortly. And our consumer ninja, you know her, Wendy Nola, taking us through the 2023-24 loyalty white paper stats. Are you loyal to a certain product? And then in our shapeshifter feature, tonight is Craig Newborn. He's the founder and CEO of PayJustNow. We'll be finding out about PayJustNow. Of course, we'd like to hear from you. You can leave a WhatsApp voice note on 072-702-1702.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
All right, let's take a closer look at Business Unusual. And have you got yourself into a situation where you've got new software and you've had to change it, but then things have gone totally wrong? And I'm thinking about what happened with Spar. They rolled out their SAP or SAP system in KwaZulu-Natal and things didn't work out so well for them there. And there was all sorts of accusations and lost money or lost profits and things like that. So you've got to be careful when you neglect or you go over to your new system, that you don't neglect what you're trying to do when it comes to training and getting your staff ready for it. Well, joining us is Zanele Njapa, who's from the Change and Transition. She's a Change and Transition consultant and also a neuro coach at the Unlearners. Zanele, hi, good evening. Good to have you on The Money Show.
Thank you so much, Ray. It's lovely to be here.
All right. First of all, what is The Unlearners? It sounds intriguing.
So The Unlearners is a consulting organization, very much like what you've said. And our big work is really to help organizations that are letting go of various ways of seeing, doing, and being, and then grabbing hold of new identities, new systems, new leaders, and sometimes even merging and acquiring. So something completely new.
All right, so how do you do that? Because nobody wants change and nobody wants the unlearners to come along and say, right, unlearn the system that you have. There's this lovely new system over there. Go with that. Do you find a lot of resistance?
Absolutely. We definitely do. And I think I really liked, Ray, that you mentioned that SPA case study earlier on. I love the interview that was done on The Money Show, funny enough, on the 30th of November with Angelo Swartz, group CEO at SPA. One of the key things that he mentioned as the four failures, one of the four failures behind that terrible, as some would say, system onboarding, is that they didn't manage the changes as well as they could. And this, for me, is really exactly what we do, is having that consideration that with digital transformation, which research says has a higher chance of failing when we compare it to transformation that is either just a regular system, onboarding a brand new leader, anything like a merger and acquisition, digital transformation has a close to 95% chance of failing. Hence the importance of going, yes, we understand people are going to resist it, but how do we put in place the systems that will make sure our people come with us on the journey? Because the truth is, Ray, no one wakes up in the morning and goes, oh my goodness, I can't wait for our beautiful SAP system that's coming on board in the organization. It's going to change my life. It's going to be absolutely phenomenal.
Not to have a go at SAP, but are there some systems that don't work and some systems that you have to research because they're not a good fit for your business? And of course, that system administrator is going to try and sell it to you because they want to make their money. But at the end of the day, it's just not a good fit.
Definitely. That is the thing. And I mean, I'm going to get onto the bandwagon with you there because we actually at the Unlearners do work with the SAP user group in Southern Africa. So definitely not to have a go with them. But I think one of the key things to note here is the understanding that a system can only work if you work it. And it is only through working it in a way that fits the organization's intentions, our strategy, but also the realistic goals that we've set for ourselves, can we then understand whether it is a fit. One of the things we've also found to be quite a tricky arena for so many organizations is having a really good understanding around the various scenarios as we execute, as we jump into the new system. What are the possibilities around this? Angelo in that interview mentioned that one of the failures was the solution readiness. It was too early to launch when they did. And so not being willing to put in the time to have the scenario planning conversations and really delve into worst case scenarios sometimes is one of the things that really does need to be done.
Yeah, because sometimes things can go really wrong. I remember working for a TV station and we had an operating system, and on the grand night that we were launching, the operating system failed and it had me fire coming out of my keyboard. It's those kind of things that, you know, companies need to know about what happens if things fail. What do you do, Zanelli? Do you actually go through the system beforehand and say to someone, this is a great system, let's implement it? Or is it just advice on the implementation?
I think it's a combination of different things, definitely. So I would say that the first thing is to be extremely clear around what we're trying to drive, because oftentimes with digital transformation, we get so seduced by the technology, by what our competitors are doing, the pace of technology, but also the looming rewards, that we jump into tech for tech's sake. And I've seen this, and this is probably the example that you're talking about with your past workplace. Mm. And so starting with what we're trying to drive, what is the objective really that we're trying to work towards? And then linking a technology that best fits to that objective. I think that that's always a really great place to start, because then you don't find yourself in a place where, like so many organizations, there is a piece of tech, but it's misaligned to what we're trying to drive. So it's not giving us those results. But also because it's something we've implemented from Germany, for example, nobody here knows how to fix it when it goes wrong. And we've got all of these different tricky areas that are going on. So I would say starting from where you need to start from and not doing digital transformation for digital transformation's sake, but really leading with your strategic intentions and your strategic goals, and then taking it from there.
And also, I suppose leaders who need to come and sit down with the workers and say, right, what works for you? What do you need? Because you're quite right. It's easy to get an operating system from, say, Germany or France because it works there. But, you know, you have to have the boss who comes and sits with the worker to say, what do you actually need?
Yes. Definitely, definitely. Because you do also find that we might have our C-suite individuals who are absolutely signed on, definitely agree, because we understand how this is going to drive what matters at the strategic level of the business. But at the end of the day, the individuals on the ground are directly connected with our customers, but not just this, Ray, our middle managers, which oftentimes is the group that gets left out when it comes to understanding exactly how this piece of technology is going to serve the business, but also serve whatever reasons they have for waking up in the morning. So I would say, very much to what you have just mentioned, it is so important to really make sure that as we roll out, our change management system is one that takes everyone on board. And it isn't just a top-down strategy, but it is one that is very bottom-up, very co-creative and very collaborative. So that as we go through that entire process, you have buy-in from various parts of the organization and you won't see this bite back or this resistance that then ends up being one of the biggest problems that causes so many transformation initiatives to just go bust.
And also as well, perhaps speak to other companies who have tried the system. What has been their experience?
It ranges. It really, really does range here. But with something like digital transformation specifically, the chances are, like I said a little bit earlier on, a lot higher for us to fail. And which is probably the reason why the focus doesn't necessarily need to be on we want to succeed in a conventional industrial way, but what does success look like for us? And then very much like what's going right back to our spa example, very much like what spa did do, and this is what I give them props for, really having an isolated rollout so that you've managed your risk, but then you've also contained just how much damage could be done, which is more or less the same thing. You can then start to track, you can go back to the drawing board and see what you do from there. Because at the end of the day, to expect complete success and flawlessness in digital transformation is very much a lie. I think we have gotten into a business environment where, because of how quickly things are moving, we expect ourselves, having human beings that are completely changing all of the time, to just grasp things at the drop of a hat, which is unreasonable, but it also doesn't work and puts unnecessary pressure on our teams.
Yeah, take the time. So Nelly Njapa, thank you so much. So Nelly is a change and transition consultant and a neuro coach at The Unlearners. We've learned a lot tonight. Thank you so much.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Right, somebody else we learn from all the time is our consumer ninja, Wendy Nola, talking tonight about the 2023-24 loyalty white paper stats. Good evening, Wendy. Good to chat to you once again.
Hello, Ray. Good to be with you again.
Right, the loyalty white paper stats. Just take us through all of that. What's that all about and who came out tops?
Okay, so the different kinds of loyalty, first of all. So I talk about the kind that all companies should be seeking to cultivate in their customers because, they're looking for loyal customers to spend more with them. But I'm saying what makes a customer loyal is not just the right products at the right price, but also trust that the company's doing the right thing at every point across the board, treating its employees right, not cutting corners to save money, abiding by laws, and always key, being transparent with its customers. But that kind of loyalty is not to be confused with what we're talking about tonight, which is loyalty programs, which is essentially the more you spend with us, the more nice things we'll give you and the more we'll actually know about you and people like you and what you want to spend money on, when right, and how, so that we can get a whole lot of free market research and tailor our products to you, which I suppose is something that we, should be a win-win ultimately. So those nice things that we get from loyalty programs take many forms and have evolved quite a lot over the years. And no surprise, the form which South Africans respond to best is the cash kind, or even probably more across mass market, the airtime data kind.
Right.
Very, very responsive to rewards of that kind. So once a year, as you said, we have the Truth Loyalty White Paper. It's the company behind it is a Cape Town-based loyalty consultancy called Truth, and they team up with Brand Map to do the surveys and produce this white paper, which reveals how many of us are taking part in the various loyalty schemes and which ones generally we like the best. So the 2023-24 loyalty white paper has just been released, and I've just pulled out some of the interesting things, the things that I think are interesting. So 76% of South African consumers use loyalty programs, which is 3%, 3 percentage points up from 2022. I think we should state, when we refer to those South African consumers, they are, and where is it now? They are not, they are, I think it's economically active South Africans who are earning more than 10,000 rand a month. So it's not the entire populace.
Sure.
So this increase in the use of loyalty programs, it's not just more people across the board, but those of us who have been using them are using them 30% more than last year, which is quite a significant increase, a spike. And this ties in, actually, since we were talking surveys, Ray, it ties in with the results of a survey conducted by market researchers NIQ, released also this week, which reveals, also unsurprisingly, that with the dire economic situation that we find ourselves in, South Africans across the board have radically changed their shopping habits. And 44% feel that they are in a worse financial position this year compared to a year ago. And 82% say that increased costs of living are to blame for their recent financial struggles, up from 76% last year. So, and one of the things that emerged from it is that South Africans are relying more on loyalty programs than they were in the previous years. So this is key, and this is,
Wendy, that's so interesting, but is it also different types? And you mentioned cash loyalty programs. It's lovely to go to a supermarket and you rip out your loyalty card and it comes to $500 your groceries and you go and swipe it and all of a sudden it's $450 and you think, oh, I got myself a deal. But then you get those other loyalty programs where you go and you got to cut out the coupon and you take that that along. The second one seems to be less in favor than the first one. Us South Africans, we seem to want that instantaneous discount, that $50 off and I've scored.
Yeah, absolutely, and it sort of feeds into customer psychology, especially in hard times. And also, we have less of an appetite now than we did a couple of decades ago for jumping through hoops. So we want it to be seamless, frictionless. I think the industry is the industry term. The less friction there is, the less you have to do, the less complicated it is, the more instant it is, and the more sort of real, tangible benefit, as in cash, or, this is going to get me X amount of airtime, the more we like it. So that's resulted in a shift in the way that these loyalty programs are structured and operated, and how we get our nice things, right? So nice stats, let's go through them. The ShopRite Group wins the most used loyalty program for economically active and mass market consumers prize. So Checkers, so they've got the Checkers Extra Savings and they've also got ShopRite Extra Savings. Right. Checkers takes number one spot as the most used loyalty program for economically active consumers. 78% usage, that is astonishing. Number two spot, and very slightly behind Checkers Extra Savings, is a Clicks Club card, which got the most used loyalty program in four out of the seven previous white papers. So it's been lauded for many years now. For mass market consumers, the sister ShopRite Extra Savings regains its place in first position as the most used. And of course, you don't build up points or anything. It's literally on certain items you can get quite a substantial discount. Okay. And then when you get to the till, it'll tell you you saved X amount. And we all like that, right? It's like that.
That's the win.
It's very direct, very transparent, exactly where you are. ShopRite shoppers present their loyalty cards in about 80% of transactions, which puts it up there with the world's best loyalty program. So that's something.
Okay.
F&B eBucks remains the only non-retail loyalty program within the top 10 most used loyalty programs. 37%, I found this astonishing, 37% of economically active consumers state that Discovery Vitality is their number one loyalty brand of choice.
That's interesting. Okay.
Isn't it? And 41% of mass market consumers say they can't live without Capitec's Live Better program. That's up 4 percentage points from last year. So I've heard a lot of people say it's like a second payday because they save it up and they pay out in the middle of the month. And I think a lot of our listeners will relate to this. And that has just been phenomenally successful for the bank as well as obviously its clients. Gosh. And then the top benefits which are enjoyed by mass market loyalty programs is airtime and data, number one, cash back, number two, and points converted then into cash, number three, which shouldn't come as any surprise to anyone. And then, interestingly, and also unsurprisingly, the industry to watch when it comes to loyalty programs is fuel.
Oh yeah.
So there's been an explosion in loyalty programs in the past 2 years. Previously, the fuel industry in this country rewarded its customers for fuel brand choice via partnerships only, because there are some legislative restrictions around the direct discounting of fuel, obviously. And so the partnership model enables fuel brands to drive increased sales via their partners. So the biggest of these are Engen, which partners with FNB eBucks, and yeah, Clicks Club Card. And all fuels, on all brands rather, are using the partnership model. So you've got Shell V, you know them all, Sasol Rewards,
yeah, BP,
Total Energies, exactly, and yeah, Astron Rewards. Yeah. Astron is a newcomer, and Total Energies last year. And the others longer going. The oldest one is Shell.
Yeah, they're pretty clever, aren't they? If you think about it, if you go and fill up and you get double the rewards, if you go to a BP or you get your V-Power, there we go, Shell, that's one just for you. They are very clever because people go back thinking, you know, if I can just increase my rewards, I can get a free tank, I can get a this or a that. At the end of the day, my question is though, Wendy, are all of these companies being honest about it? Are people getting a discount or do they think they're getting a discount?
No, they are getting a discount. They're definitely getting a discount. It's just a question of the extent of it. And that's where, you know, it's worth doing your homework in terms of exactly what your reward is, how much you have to spend to get whatever. Because I think a lot of people are faced with this, you know, where am I going to get the biggest reward? Is it using my Clicks card at Engen, or is it, there are various combinations within your bank card, right, and your Clicks card, yeah. And they, you know, it's I think from those in the know, look, I'm just a little bit I'm not very sort of A-type personality when it comes to like sitting down and working all of this out, but many are, because there's a lot of money to be made, and I think it's definitely worth it, you know, especially in this climate, to actually figure out. It's all the rewards breakdowns are all available, and just figure it out for yourself. Because yeah, to answer your question, I think there might have been a time early on where some of these rewards might have been, you know, a little bit overstated. But it's a highly competitive market now, a highly sophisticated, driven increasingly by technology, and there's a lot of gamification that's happening as well, and other, you know, the and consumers have got very sussed about it. So I don't think any of them would be very popular if there wasn't a decent reward to be had for their loyalty. Yeah, I don't think they would thrive at all.
Yeah, and people would know. People would know because we do compare and we speak. I mean, Wendy, if you think about it, I could name a few, but the few that I would name are the ones that are the favorites because they do pay out compared to some others. Yeah, they do. They do deliver. And there are others I would name as well who don't deliver, which I'm not going to do. So just speak to your friends. You'll get a general sense, won't you?
Absolutely. And they're more needed now than ever. So, and also just lastly, Roy, interesting behavior. So I'm the kind of person who'd rather save up my rewards and then buy myself something decent. Roy, where there's you, yeah, the others who just their nature and also maybe necessity will literally get that hit every time, you know, that you know, it's available, yes, I'll take it kind of thing. Whereas the others of us kind of like to make it a meaningful thing and say, right, I bought this, what I do. I bought that TV with my bank rewards, you know. It kind of makes me feel very satisfied, yeah.
I'm that guy who gets to the middle of the month and goes, oh, look, there's 30.
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
And our shapeshifter tonight is Craig Newborn. He's the CEO of Pages Now. And I've been reading his bio, and I love this. While 100% committed to making Pages Now available to more customers at more locations, Craig remains committed to his belief that time is valuable, and he fiercely values his time with his family. Two afternoons a week, without fail, he can be found at the poolside or sidelines cheering on his three children. His favorite meal is sushi, because that's what his kids love. His favorite binge is The Block, because that's what his wife watches. He farms garlic and kiwi fruit with his brother and still makes time to read up on the latest business concepts. Craig, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray. Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, do you really like The Block? I'm just asking for a friend.
No, I mean, I think it's an amazing show. I think the production that they put on is unbelievable, and it's really amazing what can be achieved in 7 days. I'm not sure of the quality, but it looks great on Sunday evening, at least for the cameras.
Lovely. Right. Talking about achieving things, tell us more about Pages Now. What is Pages Now for those who don't know?
So Pages Now is a buy now, pay later business, which I founded. What it allows you to do, it allows you to purchase something, and we split that purchase into three equal installments. So a great example is a new set of tires and for your car, going into Easter weekend, and we split that set of tires, that 12,000 rand set of tires, into three equal payments of, you know, obviously of 4,000 rand each. You pay 4,000 on the day that you purchase the tires. You get the tires immediately. You pay the further 4,000 1 month later, and the further 4,000 the month after that. The cash price and the price you pay us are exactly the same. It's a no interest or no fees product. It's completely free to you as the consumer, as the buyer. And as long as you pay on time, the cash price is exactly the same as the split price. So you can actually keep money in your savings account and make money on the tires you've just bought. So it's quite a crazy concept.
Yeah, it's a great concept. It really is. All right. You said as long as you pay on time. What happens if you don't?
So if you don't, obviously we enter into an incidental agreement at that point in time, because we've got a cost of capital, right? So we're financing you for the three payments, and we then charge a late fee to recover that, to reprocess the payment each time we try and collect, and then obviously phone you and collect. It's a very, very small percentage of people who don't pay us. It's less than 2%. It's been quite a journey. The business has grown considerably over the years, 104% in the last year, and we've processed over 1.5 billion rand worth of these split payments last year.
Yeah. Craig, it's lovely to have your own business. It gives you a sense of freedom. It can also be quite worrying as well. Take us through the early stages. Where did you get the concept from? And perhaps were you also working somewhere else and you thought, hold on, I've got this concept?
So I've always been an entrepreneur through my early days. I started my first business at school, but I actually was involved with another business, which I still own. And I got to a point where I was incredibly bored. And that business had done incredibly well. And I started looking at concepts globally, and I noticed this concept of buy now, pay later, specifically interest-free and fee-free, and I was intrigued by how is that technically possible? How could someone finance something for me at the till and charge me the same cash price? It just doesn't make any sense, right? So I saw this concept in Australia and subsequently in Europe, and I thought, hang on, I've got to get to the bottom of this. So I literally researched over several months and realized how the model works. And how the model actually works is the retailer, whoever is selling you the goods, gives us a rebate similar to like a credit card transaction, where the bank charges the credit the retailer a fee for accepting credit cards in exactly the same way. That is exactly how we make money. And I then realized that very early on that I needed to I couldn't just take a foreign concept and bring it to South Africa. A lot of the foreign concepts collect money every second week because they were born on the Australian model, where most of Australia is paid on twice a month every second week. And we had to take that concept and obviously make it local, right? I realized very quickly we needed to develop trust with the South African customer. South Africans understand the word just now. I quickly was able to wordmark pay just now, and I flew to Bangalore in India and bought the domain from a chap on the corner of a street. and we literally built what you see today as pay just now over a course of 6 months, and then obviously had to put a big team around myself to be able to scale this business to the point of where it's got today.
Yeah. How do you even build a business like that? You have all these legends that they started out in their garage. Did you start out in your garage with your team, or what were the early stages? Because I would think if all of a sudden people heard about you and they thought, oh, I need some tires, let's do it this way, things could get really busy really quick.
Absolutely. So I think where we started was actually in a coffee shop. We had this great barista called Gerald, and he made unbelievable coffee. And we, for the first 6 months, we were at a corner in a coffee shop. We hadn't launched yet. It took us just over 6 months to build the platform as you see it today. I come from a technical background, and I had the support of one of my other ventures, and we built the platform. But I very quickly realized that I needed key team members, right? And so the, one of the first people I realized is that we're going to have to convince retailers that this is a good idea. And who best to convince a retailer that this is a good idea than a retailer? So yeah. I went and found a colleague of mine, Greg van der Riet, and I went to him and I said, hey, he just recently exited a business, and I need you to come and sell to retailers because you guys talk a different language. And I think you need to make this happen for me. So he came down, flew down from Durban, started commuting. We're based in Cape Town. And then I very quickly realized, okay, great, we can get retailers, but customers are going to start phoning us. And one of my pet peeves is service, right? I think in South Africa, we get a really raw deal on service. So I found another colleague who was in my school class, my son's school class, and I asked Mark to join us and say, Mark, I need you to run service for me. It's one of the most crucial elements of our business, and to be able to look after my customers and make them feel like they are part of our journey, and they are part of our journey, and we need to celebrate them, and I need you to help me build a service team, but I need you to build it with very few people because we needed to scale the business ourselves. And slowly we found very key individuals who were able to join our team really, really quickly, such as Dean, who joined us from the finance side, and because we had to raise capital quite quickly. And you're 100% right. The business scaled very, very quickly. We're 5 years old. We're doing over 1.5 billion rands worth of trade. And it happened very quickly. The year before, we did 750 million rands worth of trade. And we were able to, I was able to rely on this team and make it happen. And then we subsequently sold a significant stake of the business to Weaver FinTech, and they have been able to give us the commercial and lending support to help build this book, right? Because we settle the merchant straight after the sale. So as soon as you transact, we wire the money to the merchant, obviously less our fee, and we are out for obviously two-thirds of the payment. You've paid a third.
Sure.
Yeah.
Interesting, Craig. It's really, really, really interesting how you built up your business model. We're talking to Craig Newborn, who's the CEO of Pay Just Now. More in a bit.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Now, shapeshifter tonight is the CEO of Pages Now, Craig Newborn. Now, Craig, before the break, we were talking about volume, and I heard you saying how you set up your team and you got things going. But how many businesses or sort of vendors or retailers are you tied into?
So we are available at over 2,500 retailers that we've directly integrated into the platform, and you can use us at just over 8,000 locations in South Africa. That is both online and in store. You see us on the checkout of your most favorite retailers online, and in store you can go directly to the till and scan the QR code with our app. And you can check out and walk away with the goods on the day. Obviously, from a responsibility perspective, we need to make sure that you can actually afford the things that you're buying. And obviously, you are who you say you are.
Yeah, that's the other thing as well. And returns, I would think, would be with the vendor or the retailer. It wouldn't go through you.
So it does, obviously. It does actually come back to us. The retailer lets us know that you're returning goods, because obviously we don't want to be collecting money from you for goods that you've actually returned. So that's a fully integrated model where the retailer can actually process the return on our platform directly from the tool. It's a fully automated process. You then, you know, if you've paid the full amount, we actually provide you with an instant credit, and you can use that money to shop straight away for a different purchase or at a different merchant. It's really, really simple. No sort of waiting for your money to be processed back to your credit card or your debit card, for that matter. It's instantly available.
Gosh, that's so interesting. Right, so I'm going to fire some questions at you, because, you know, hearing you say this, you must have no time to yourself whatsoever. So here we go. Here's one for you. How do you balance, this is also from our listeners in 702 in Cape Talkland, how do you balance your business and your families? The SMS has come through saying, Ray, you started talking about his family, but how does he spend some time at the pool if he's got so many vendors that he's attending to?
So it's all about team. It's all about being able to grow that team around you, realizing that you as a founder of a business have to delegate. You have to find people that are better at things than you are, and you've got to empower them. And I've been very, very lucky to be able to achieve that with the team. And then also turning off, right? I think that's a key fundamental. I don't wear a smartwatch and my phone is permanently on silent, because I value my time to review things when I want to review them, and focus on my family.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because I think so many business leaders can actually learn from you. Many CEOs can't switch off. They don't want to switch off, and it becomes like a demon that possesses them. And you see the divorce rate go up. You see kids hating their fathers or mothers, because there's a lesson to be learned here.
Yes. Agreed wholeheartedly. Completely. I agree that I think it's something that you have to take the time. And as I used to wear a smartwatch, and I used to have my phone, you know, available all the time. And I now don't. You know, the sun will come up tomorrow morning.
Yeah. Is this a business that's perhaps a legacy for your children one day? Do you see them taking over from you, or are you just going to leave them this empire and say to them, well, guys, this is what I built for you. You can sell it or take part in it.
So my view on this is quite an interesting one. I believe that purpose is really important in business. And I'm not sure, you know, our children often share the same purpose as necessarily the founders. And so in that scenario, I always think you should be ready for sale, and you should sell and allow your kids to follow their purpose. I think people who follow their purposes will make a significant contribution to changing the world we are in today.
Yeah, it actually leads me on to my next question as well. At what point do you decide to yourself, it's time to sell? Because if I hang on to this business, there may be a bit of a downturn, and I may not. It's a bit like betting, I suppose, or going to the casino. You need to know when to quit.
Sure. Very good question. I think I think it's, you know, as a founder, I believe in that you, as I've spoken, you need to replace yourself in each of the roles over time. And that should actually be your goal. Your goal should be to replace the head of marketing being yourself, the head of finance when you started and paid those merchants individually. And I think when you get to the, you have replaced yourself, are you still excited to continue driving the business forward? Is there someone who can do it better than you? And then I think you should be always asking that question. And if the question is there is someone that can drive it forward and make it better than you can, then I do think you should appoint them. And I think either continue in the business as a different role, as a catalyst, helping the business grow. But yeah, I think at that point is always a good time to consider. Is it something I should be selling? Is it highly cash generative? And am I happy? That's the reality. If you're not happy, then I think it's time.
Yeah. Another one says, good evening. How does he offer employment? He says, how can I apply for a job? How big is your staff? What are you looking at?
So the total staff complement is 66 people. We have over 1.4 million customers that have trusted us and onboarded on our platform. You can apply for careers at careers@pagesnow.com. That's the email address. And we do post our open roles on LinkedIn. Yeah, so we look forward to receiving those opportunities.
But of course, as well, you've got to deal with this volume of work, and you can't have an artificial intelligence robot doing this. But perhaps you may be looking at some sort of AI at some point to get you pointed in the right direction to deal with this volume. So you can be sitting on a beach somewhere with your kids, having your cigar and your drink as the sun goes down, thinking, oh, look, I've made another million.
So yes, absolutely. I mean, if you think that we sign up an F&B stadium in full of customers in a month, regularly, you know, 90,000 people, that has to be automated. So we do make use of AI in the business. We do make use of machine learning and cloud technology to be able to scale to the point of where we are. But we use it to help us make decisions or to help the humans be able to decipher quickly what needs to be done and help our human team be able to answer our customers responsively. You know, our service team is only 14 people servicing 1.4 million customers. And, you know, we've got a 4.8 rating out of 5 and over 2,000 people have actively reviewed us. So, we've got to keep our service levels up and we've got to be able to scale the business. So we have to make use of these sort of AI tech to help us scale.
That's absolutely amazing. So you'd have these programs running. So if somebody did phone through or they did email through or, you know, they went onto your chat platform, they can just go and there's a fully automated, let's check your credit. Let's have a look if you're trustworthy. You've got it all worked out, don't you?
So absolutely. So, and it also, and if you do speak to a human, that AI bot has actually been through similar cases. So if you've described it to us what your problem is, it's actually provides suggested content as to how the agent can help you. And written reference documentation that we could share with the customer. So, hey, here's an article of a customer that had a similar problem, and this is how you solve it. Here are the actual pictures of navigating on the app as an example. And that helps us deliver significant scale to our customers. And as I said, one of my pet peeves is bad service. And it's something that we are investing in massively.
Gosh, Craig Newborn, the founder and CEO of PagesNow. It's been fascinating chatting to you tonight and all the best for the future. I look forward to going to your website.
Thanks very much, Ray. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Craig. Wow, absolutely fascinating tonight. There are ways to make money in this world.